You're listening to the Liberty Grace Church Sermon Podcast. For more information, visit libertygrace.ca.
We all want the same thing. We all want happiness. Every single one of us, every person in this room, and every person who is in this community. The question is, how do we actually get it? In this world of hardship and COVID and amazing things and hard things, how do we actually get happiness? And that's a question that all of us face. We're on this perpetual search to find happiness. Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote the book Eat, Pray, Love, and that later became a movie, she said this: happiness is the consequence of personal effort. And so she's saying, you know, if you work hard, you'll get it. You fight for it, you strive for it, you insist upon it, and sometimes even travel around the world looking for it. Well, we used to travel around the world looking for it. She says, you have to participate relentlessly in the manifestations of your own blessings. And once you have achieved a state of happiness, you must never become lax about maintaining it. That sounds exhausting, doesn't it? You have to work to get it, and once you get it, you have to work to keep it. You must make a mighty effort to keep swimming upward into that happiness forever, to stay afloat on top of it. Somebody posted a picture of a salmon swimming upstream. I always love to see the salmon doing that, jumping up a waterfall. And that what she's saying is happiness is kind of like that. You got to swim upstream, and it's going to be hard, but you need to keep going for it. But that's what all of us are doing. We're all looking for happiness. We're all looking for ways to get the joy, the satisfaction, the just contentment that we long for. And there are only so many options to do it. And that's where we find ourselves today. We find ourselves in the book of Ecclesiastes. This is not a new quest. This is something that's been going on for centuries, for millennia. And this is really what the passage that was read for us today is all about. So last week we began looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a wisdom book. Right in the middle of the Bible, there's a number of books that are called the wisdom books of the Bible. And wisdom is not, if we think of a wise person as being somebody who's, and rightfully so, as being having exceptional insight, of being this person who is above everybody else. Well, in the Bible, wisdom is not seen as being the domain of some people. Solomon certainly was wiser than anybody else, but wisdom in the Bible is available to anyone who's low enough to receive it. In the Bible, God reveals the way to live in the world. In the book of Proverbs, we have the different wisdom books, and Proverbs pictures wisdom as being a woman crying out in the streets, and anybody who has ears to hear can receive what she has to say. And so the good news is for all of us, if you want to live wisely, you don't have to become smarter. You don't have to find somebody who knows more than you do. You have to turn to God's word and learn what God says about how to live well in this world. And so this is the subject. How do we live skillfully in this broken world? How do we live our lives so our lives are actually beautiful, that they make sense, that they're congruent with the world, that somebody would look at our lives and say, that is a life well lived. And last week we began, we looked at the different types of wisdom books, some that deal with suffering, one that deals with suffering, one that deals with love, one that deals with the nitty-gritty details of life, and this one, which is about life in this very difficult world. And so if you feel like life is difficult, this is a book that says you're not wrong. Let's explore how we live life in this world. A world that last week, as we saw, is temporary, fleeting, and repetitive. We began last week by looking at the fact that life is a vapor. It's getting cold enough that soon you'll be able to breathe and see this vapor. How do you live with when life is like that? It's so hard to get a hold of. You breathe out and it disappears and it's gone. How do we find happiness in a world like this? Well, one way is to try to run some experiments. That's what Gretchen Rubin did. Gretchen Rubin is a author of a number of books, including one called The Happiness Project. And for a year, she tried different experiments to see which ones would bring her happiness. And so she tried things like singing in the morning, cleaning her closet, reading Aristotle, and so on to see which ones would make her happy. That is not too far from what the preacher does in this passage of scripture. He runs a series of experiments to see which ones lead to happiness. And so I want to look today, because the experiments he tried aren't that different from what you and I try today. And we're going to see that not much has changed. These are the same experiments we try today. So I think it makes sense to look at what he did, because he had a lot more access to resources than most all of us did, to be honest, and find out what he discovered as he ran each of these experiments. So here is the first experiment. Experiment number one, learning. The preacher starts with learning. And you might be saying, okay, that's not my approach. That's not what I'm going to try. But verse 13, he says, I think we actually do try this a lot. Verse 13, he says, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And what he says here is, I'm going to conduct a comprehensive search. The scope is actually breathtaking. He's leaving no stone unturned. It's not a cursory search. He's going to examine everything. He wants to look at how to live a good life. He's going to look at philosophy. He's going to look at religion. He's going to look at best practices. He wants to look at everything to find out how well to live. In fact, in verse 17, he says, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. So not only is he going to settle for looking for wisdom, but he's going to go, maybe the answer is found in foolishness. So I'm going to examine that as well. Today, I think the search would look something like this. I'm going to study alternate worldviews. I'm going to maybe do comparative religions. I mean, maybe Buddhism has something that I'm missing. I'm going to go to the East and try to discover what Eastern philosophy has to say. I'm going to become well-educated so that I understand how this world operates. I'm going to go on Amazon. I'm going to conduct a comprehensive search to see what all the books on happiness say. I'm going to just do everything I can to find the answer to life's problems. Well, this search is actually admirable in many ways. So chapter 2, verse 13, he says that one of the conclusions he comes to in 2:13 is this: I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there's more gain in light than in darkness. And so what he's actually saying is, hey, just everybody knows, learning is good. Don't throw away your degrees if you have them. Don't stop reading books. This pursuit is a good one. But he also says that this pursuit, this experiment, fell short in a couple of areas. And I think that you and I can relate to this. So verse 15 of chapter 1, the experiment of learning failed for a couple reasons. Here's the first. He says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What he's saying here is, there are some unsolvable problems. There are some things that no matter how much you learn, you can't make something that's crooked straight. No matter how much you learn, all the learning in the world will not solve certain problems. And then he says, what is lacking cannot be counted. There are some things that we can't know. Even to this day, there's answers that the smartest people in this world can't answer. So no matter how much you learn, there's going to be unsolvable problems, and there's going to be things where we bump against our ignorance. There will always be some aspects of life that remain a mystery, no matter how hard we try to understand them. Verse 18, he gives a second problem with learning. He says in verse 18, in much wisdom there is vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Understanding more doesn't always make us happy. That's why they say, have you heard it? Ignorance is what? Bliss. There's a reason they say that, because sometimes not knowing is actually a comfort. As somebody else said, John Cheever, the main emotion of the adult American who has had all the advantages of wealth, education, and culture is actually disappointment. I am not anti-learning. I love learning. I love reading. I plow through books like crazy. But what the says here is somebody who applied himself to learning is that you won't find happiness at the bookstore. You won't find happiness in your next degree. You won't find happiness by finding a guru who's got the answers to life, no matter how good they are. The learning experiment can't make you happy. At least it can't give you the happiness that you're looking for. Okay, so that's number one, first experiment. It's good. Learning is good, but learning won't make you happy. What's experiment two that he tries out here? I think you'll like this one a little bit more. Experiment number two is pleasure. In verse one of chapter two, he says, I said in my heart, by the way, I like how he talks to himself, right? I love the account here. He's like, okay, that didn't work. Let's try another thing. So I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. And he goes through verses 2 to 8, talks about all the things that he tried. He tried comedy. He tried alcohol. He tried all the finer things in life. He had the best houses and the best gardens and all the accoutrements. His living arrangements could be featured in a glossy magazine. On top of that, he had women. He had more sexual partners than anyone could imagine. He denied himself nothing. He became a hedonist. He had it all. Well, how did this experiment run? And by the way, this is very popular today, right? Like, sign me up. I want this plan for finding happiness. Well, verse 9, he says, this is a result. I became great and surpassed all those who were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom remained with me. So he actually enjoyed a good life. There were some good things that came from this. He actually succeeded in the pleasure experiment. And you see this approach everywhere. The modern version of this would be make enough money so that you can live a good life, hit bar, party, have lots of sex, buy nice stuff. Or if you want a lighter version of this, it would be to distract yourself with diversions, social media, games, and entertainment to numb the pain in your life. But he says in verse 2, or verse 1, he reports right at the beginning. And verse 11, he reports the results of the experiment. He says in verse 2, he says, but this also was vanity. Verse 11, he says, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. We know this, right? Verse 11, the today's English version says, I realized that it didn't mean a thing. It was like chasing after the wind. We know this, right? You turn from a vacation. You could have had the best vacation ever. Enjoy your vacations. They're a gift from God. But you return home from vacation, and 2 days later, you feel like, did I even have a vacation? Like, was that another life? That just seemed like, what good did it do? I enjoyed it in the moment, and now I'm back at work. It's like I never even had the vacation. Or no matter how good a weekend you have, the result of all the drinking, the result of as much sex as you want, the next day you wake up and there's still something missing in your life. After he enjoyed everything, he still felt empty. You know, it's actually ironic. The harder we go after pleasure, the less pleasure we find. The more we have to up the stakes to keep the same level of pleasure. It's never enough. And it's by design, because nothing perishable will ever satisfy us, no matter what we get to enjoy. C.S. Lewis, if you know anything about his life, he married an American. Her name was Joy Davidman. And Joy Davidman said this, living for his own pleasure is the least pleasurable thing a person can do. Hear that again. Living for pleasure is the least pleasurable thing a person can do. If your neighbors don't kill you in disgust, you will die slowly of boredom and lovelessness. It doesn't work. It doesn't work to pursue learning as a way to get happiness. And the second experiment, it doesn't work to pursue pleasure as a way to find the happiness that you're looking for. It works in the short term, but it just doesn't satisfy you the way that you want it to. Okay, so two experiments so far. He's going to give one more. Experiment three is achievement. And while we look at this experiment, we've already seen little bits of it with all his building projects and everything going on. I want to just tell you, this is my drug of choice. So I'm out of all these things, these ways of finding happiness, I think this is probably where I would end up wanting to go. And some of you are saying, hey, dude, try pleasure. It's way better. Okay, but this, I'm just being honest. Get things done. Do things. Make a difference. Leave your mark in the world. Achieve enough. Do enough. And you will hopefully, this is the experiment, you will find what your soul is longing for. Get that next career move. Accomplish that next project. Do something that will last. It's kind of dangerous to quote Karl Marx, although not around here, maybe more, he's more palatable than other places, but Karl Marx said this, labor is the very touchstone of man's self-realization. Man labors to transform his world, to put his own mark upon it, and to make it his. Isn't that true? We try to transform the world by, we try to leave our mark by our career, by doing the right things. Work is where a lot of us get meaning in our lives. Plot the right career move, get in the right position, get noticed, get promoted, build a name for yourself, accomplish something. I've talked to people in Liberty Village. I'll never forget talking to a 24-year-old. He'd been working for a company for 2 years. He said, I still can't believe they haven't promoted me right to the top. Like, I've given my all to this company for 2 years. And Charlie and I were laughing. It's like, you've only been there 2 years. Like, come on, give me a break. But I see this drive, it's all around us, this drive to make something of ourselves, to achieve and to get ahead. Verses 4 to 6, we already looked at this. We saw that he made great works and built houses and planted vineyards, made himself gardens and parks, planted all kinds of fruit trees, made himself pools. He was getting stuff done. In verses 18 to 20, he reports the results of this. He said, I hated all my toil, which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I've toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. And so I turned about and gave up my heart to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. What he's saying is, no matter how hard you work, you're going to have to leave it behind. Somebody else will sit in your chair one day. And to make it worse, he says, that person might be an idiot. Everything you work for might be taken over by somebody who's just incompetent, who ruins everything that you spent your life building. Shani and I go through Ontario Place quite often, through Trillium Park. I love that just because it's beautiful, because there's so much nostalgia there from my childhood. But we get to the West Island, and you go around, and there's this log ride that I remember going on so many times. And you see this log ride, it's beautiful because it's abandoned and overrun with plants and everything. And once I go by there and I think, I remember when they built that. And this thing that they poured all this effort into, that they designed and studied and that people enjoyed, now is lying there in ruins as an artifact of the past that everybody's forgotten. And if they look at it, they just go, it's a wreck. And it's a picture of our work. One day, everything that we built, everything that we've worked for, will be lying there like a wreck. And if people even notice at all, it'll just be like, look at that. Like, can you imagine somebody did all of that? Everything in life is temporary and fleeting and repetitive. We want happiness. And all these experiments are ones we try. We try learning and pleasure and achievement to try to get them. But again, the writer is putting up a big dead end sign here. He's saying to all of us, you will not get the happiness you're looking for by going down this road. All these things will not give you what you're looking for. Do not enter. And by the way, some of you are saying, Daryl, this is the most depressing series we've ever done at this church ever. You should be glad that I skipped 2:12 to 16, which confronts us with mortality. That brings up that even if these things did work, we would have to face the problem of death. That one day you will die, and no matter how good your life is, it will be over. And that confronts us with the reality that everything we have truly is a vapor and won't last. So if you take a good look at this world, He's saying that stop trying to learn to find happiness. Stop trying to chase pleasure, party, sex, alcohol to find pleasure. Stop trying to leave your mark as a way to find meaning in your souls. None of them will give you the happiness you're looking for. Okay. In the middle of all these experiments, there's a ray of hope. In chapter 2, verses 24 to 25, for the first time in the book of Ecclesiastes, light shines through. It's been depressing. And in verse 24 and 25 of chapter 2, finally, the first sign of hope. He says this, hear these words, take them in, feel these words. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Were you expecting this? At this point, talk about a right turn, right? There's nothing better that you should eat and drink and find enjoyment in your toil. This I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? What is he saying here? What he's saying is, see if this makes sense. We're all searching for happiness. We're running all these experiments trying to find the happiness that we're looking for. And he breaks in here and he says, maybe it's been right in front of us all along. Maybe the good things in life, while we're searching for all the things for meaning and in learning and pleasure and achievement, maybe all along the happiness, some of the things, the happiness we're designed to enjoy is right in front of us. Good food, good drink, enjoyment of our work. And he says, maybe they aren't meant to satisfy us. I think that is what he's saying, but maybe they're gifts from God that point us to something greater. They're not ultimate, but they're still good. And so maybe every day he's saying, God gives us things that won't ultimately satisfy us, but that are meant for our joy and to point us to the source of our true happiness. They're gifts from God that aren't enough to fill the hole in our souls, but they're still gifts from God meant to bring us joy and to point us to him. C.S. Lewis said something profound. He said, the books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. He's saying, like, all these books that are so beautiful, all the music you hear, they're going to betray you if you trust them. It was not in them. It only came through them. If they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country that we have not yet visited. Another time he said this, probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy, but to arouse it ourselves to suggest the real thing. I think what he's saying here is, friends, every day, including today, God has given you countless blessings, things that bring a smile to your face, that bring you joy. If you put your hope in them, they will crush under the weight of your expectations. They will not give you the happiness that you're looking for. But if you receive them as gifts from God, as reminders that we serve a good God who loves us, they can be pointers to his goodness. They can be pointers to the one who ultimately can satisfy our souls. He's saying that we can taste God's goodness even in the middle of this difficult life. God is not upset that you like all the blessings that he's given you. Everything you have that's good is a gift from him. Enjoy them. Enjoy your friends. Enjoy good food. Later on, Ecclesiastes is going to go out of the way to say, like, eat good food, wear the clothes that make you feel good, drink amazing stuff, like, whatever you can find, enjoy it. But don't expect them to make you happy. They were never designed to do that. They were designed to point you to what will ultimately satisfy your soul. And that is not any of the stuff, but it's God himself. Later on, we're going to celebrate communion, those of us who are here in person. We're going to take a little prepackaged, made in a factory, a little wafer and sugary grape juice that isn't even that good. And we're going to take it and it's going to sit on our tongue and we're going to drink it. Man, I miss how we used to have communion. But we're going to have that. And that is barely enjoyable. But it is a pointer to a greater feast that we will enjoy. That's actually a pointer to the greatest gift that could ever be given to us, the gift of God's own Son, Jesus, who died for us, took all our shame upon him, all of our sin. What if all the things we get to enjoy are just weak pointers to the goodness of God, especially in giving us his Son? Friends, we won't find happiness in learning, pleasure, or achievement, but all these earthly joys can point us to the one who can truly satisfy us. And so enjoy this life. Love your work. Enjoy your relationships. Have fun. Eat good food. But don't expect any of this to satisfy you. They're good gifts from the one who can ultimately satisfy you. And when you have God in these gifts, then you'll have something worth living for. And so, Father, help us to enjoy your gifts, not for themselves, but a signpost to what will ultimately satisfy us, which is you. May we all find the happiness we're looking for in you through Jesus. I pray in his name. Amen.